Okay, so y'all ready to get started? So here we are in chapter 3, and what we're talking about now is what is the role of government? And the point being made here is that even in a free enterprise system, we need a strong central government. So for what reasons do we need a strong central government? And that's what we've got here. First one that we talked about is establishes and enforces rules of the game. Even in a free market system, you got to look at it as a game, right? And the game's got to have rules, and so that we have order and cooperation, and those rules have to be enforced. Of course, there may be some disagreement on what should the rules be, what should the laws be, and there are good laws and there are bad laws, and there are laws that may help the free enterprise system, and there are laws that may hurt the free enterprise system. In fact, we'll look at some of those later. But the point is that we need a strong central government here in order to establish and enforce rules of the game. Well, the second one that we've got here is promotes competition. Without government, it's possible that businesses can grow very large. See, once a business gets its root and establishes itself, it can gain market share due to its size. This gives newcomers a great disadvantage. So what the government says is, well, in order for a free market system to operate, we need a certain amount of competition here. And so we're not going to allow any one company to have too much market power in any one industry. And this is where we have what are called antitrust laws. Antitrust laws. Now, the word trust comes from the practice around the turn of the 1900 when companies in the same industry would form trusts. And instead of competing against one another, they would cooperate and they would act as if they were a monopoly and therefore have a great deal of market power where the prices tend to be higher and the quantity produced tended to be lower. So an antitrust law is a law against trusts. All right, the third thing is regulates natural monopolies. Normally, we don't like monopolies because the consumer can be taken unfair advantage, but there are cases where we actually want monopolies. For example, the case with the power companies. Why do we want a power company in any one area to have a monopoly? Well, then let me explain to you what a natural monopoly is, because a power is an example of a natural monopoly. First of all, in order to supply power to an area, it takes a lot of sunk costs, a lot of upfront costs, and it takes a great deal of time. Now, investors are going to invest in whatever they think is a good deal. Wherever they think they can make a good return, that's what they're going to invest in. All right, so investors look at the power business, and they say, well, this could be a good area to make a profit in, but it's going to take so much time to build the power generators and run the poles and the wires and hire all the people and it's going to be very expensive, and we got to know what our customer base is going to be. Now, this area's got so much population, and we figured that if 95% of those people buy power from us, that this could justify our investment. But what happens if some other power company comes in and takes half our customers? Well, if only 50% of the people in this area buy power from us, that's not going to justify our costs. So there's just too much risk here. We would rather take our money somewhere else where we can still make a return and the risk is a lot lower. Well, as a result, do we get power built in areas? And the answer is, well, no. I mean, in a free market system, the investors won't want to take that great risk. So how do we make sure that these private companies come and build the power plants? The government says, look, if you come into this area and if you're willing to make all this investment, we'll give you monopoly status. We'll pass a law saying that no power company can compete with you. Now the investors say, well, at least we know what our customer base is going to be. And based on this customer base, we figure 95% will buy from us, and that's sufficient enough to justify our investment. You all know by this time that whatever the government gives with one hand, they take away with the other, right? So in this case, what does the government take away? Company ABC will give you monopoly status in this area. What the government takes away is the ability for the power company to charge whatever price they want. See, that would be unfair. Okay, now they're a monopoly. We need power. They're the only ones we can buy power from. That gives them a tremendous amount of market power. So the government says, well, now, we're the ones that gave you this monopoly status, but we've got to approve your price structure. And once you want to raise your price, you've got to justify why you want to raise your price. And only after we say you can raise your price can you raise your price. And so that's the way natural monopolies work. Like cable companies are natural monopolies. Anyway, that's one function of why we need a strong central government. Another reason we need strong central government is to provide us with public goods. Now, what is a public good? A public good is a good that once produced, everyone benefits and no one can be excluded. For example, roads is a public good. Now, if it weren't for government, how would we build our roads? And how would we pay for our roads? If it weren't for government now, and if not for government, there's no taxes, how could we pay for roads? Well, you'd have to have private investors come in. They would buy up stretch of land, and they would build roads and then put up toll booths. And then they would charge tolls. Like between here and Christiansburg, there might be 10 toll roads. So you drive for a while, and then that road would end, and you get off and you pay a toll, and then you get on another road, and then you get off and pay a toll, and on like that. And because there's no government, there's no one to say how these roads have to be built. I mean, some are wide, some are narrow, some are gravel, some are asphalt, some are just dirt. I mean, there's no unification here, you see. There's no one to say that the roads ought to be thus wide and made of this material and like that. So, with government, though, what can we do? Well, with government, we can tax. We take taxes, and we build the roads. And because of a strong central government, we can build our roads that are uniform width, and they're all asphalt, and we can paint lines on them that make sense to everybody, and like that, you see. And, of course, we got because of government, we have speed limits to make driving safe, and we can say that, you know, everyone drives on the right-hand side of the road, and like that, you see. Now, which taxes, by the way, pay for our roads? No, every time we buy a gallon of gasoline, there's a tax on that gallon. All the money comes from taxes on gasoline. So, who ends up paying most of the taxes?
Everybody buys gasoline.
Yeah, Mo, right? Those who drive the most pay the most taxes. Now, is that a fair way of doing it? Yeah, that's a pretty fair way of doing it. Now, see, what are some other public goods? Well, like public education. If it weren't for public education, then how much would it cost for you to educate your children or for you to be educated here in college? You know that right now your tuition is highly subsidized by the state. I mean, if you had to pay the full cost of what it is to provide education, most of you wouldn't be here. Only the wealthy could afford an education. So what we do is we have government, We tax people, we take that money, we build schools, and then we subsidize tuition. Like in elementary and high school, we say, well, you can go and get a high school education and you don't have to pay anything out of your pocket. I mean, it all comes through tax money. Now, if you go to college, we're going to subsidize that too, but not as much as in high school. So when you go to college, you are going to pay a certain amount, and then we'll pay a certain amount. Now, why is the tuition less here in New River than it would be to take the same course at Tech or Radford? In fact, it's about a third the price. And it's fully transferable. How come you're paying less tuition? Well, because for several reasons, we have decided that community college students will be more highly subsidized than students at a four-year school. See, that's the main reason why your tuition is less, because you're being more highly subsidized. You know, I was talking to some students, international students that are attending Radford University, and they're from Denmark. Now, in Denmark, you could go to the university and pay no tuition. In fact, in Denmark, if you're a student, you get $800
a month. You get $800
a month? Yeah, every student gets $800 a month. And there's no tuition. So what am I saying? Well, what I'm saying is, okay, public education is a public good. How much do we subsidize it? Well, that's up to whoever makes the laws, right? I mean, like here we say, well, we're going to subsidize high school education 100%, but we'll subsidize college education, less. Whereas in Denmark, they say, well, we're going to subsidize college education 100%, just like in high school. I mean, these are just decisions that, we make as a society. So the point here, though, is that there's all kinds of public goods that once they're produced, everyone benefits from and no one can be excluded from. And these public goods can only be built and financed through taxes. And you can only have taxes if you have a strong government. That was really the point. So that's public goods. Another reason we need government is a government deals with externalities. Now, what is an externality? There are positive externalities and negative externalities, and what we normally talk about here is negative externalities. A negative externality is the undesirable byproduct of the industrial process. Like, we like the cars that we buy, but we don't like all the pollution that goes along with them. Pollution is a negative externality. Why is it that businesses cannot provide us with a clean environment? I mean, why is it not possible for a business owner to have a social conscience? I mean, let's say all of us here were in the same industry. And let's say that we all, like we're all paper companies. Now, we manufacture paper. And let's say that we're all the same size to begin with, and we all share the same part of the market, and our costs are identical. And we're pretty much identical companies. Now, you come along, and you say, I feel guilty about running that pipe out my back door and running all these liquid waste into the lake, and because the lake is getting terribly polluted, and I feel guilty about all this soot going up in my smokestacks, and it's causing all kinds of health problems, and so I'm going to put scrubbers in my smokestacks so that I don't cause so much air pollution, and I'm going to find out ways to dispose my liquid waste so I just don't have to dump them in the lake.
That all costs money.
Yeah, that costs money, right? And because all that costs money, what do you got to do to your price to make up for the increase in costs? Raise your price. Well, now, if you raise your price above our price, because remember, we started when we were all pretty much equal and we were charging the same price. Well, if you charge... Now, have we done anything to improve the quality of the paper?
No.
No, all we've done is pay for these anti-pollution things, right? So, you've got to raise your price. Your price is higher than our price. Consumers walk in the store. They see your paper. They see our paper. Your paper is 20% more in price. Which paper are they going to buy?
The
cheapest paper, less expensive one. So with almost no one buying from you, because they can buy from the rest of us for a lot less money, what's going to happen to you? You're going to go out of business. And that's why business owners cannot have a social conscience. See, in other words, without government, there's no way to solve a pollution problem. So what do? Well, the government comes in here and says, well, now we've got a pollution problem, and so we've got to have these environmental guidelines that apply to everybody. Now, of course, there may be some disagreement on what those guidelines are, but there is uniform agreement on, well, at least this is a viable role of government. Yes, we need government in this area, or we'd all be choking to death with pollution. All right? So that's another reason that we need government, is that we need government to deal with externalities. Well, another reason we need government is that government promotes a more equal distribution of income. Now, remember, in an earlier lecture, I showed you that that he who has will be given more, and he who does not have, that thing that he does not have will be taken away. Remember that? You know, if you've got $1,000 and you put $1,000 in a savings account, what's the bank going to do? They're going to give you money. Now, if you go buy a $20,000 car and you don't have the money to pay for it, so you got to finance it over 3 to 5 years. After 3 to 5 years, that $20,000 car might cost you $25,000. Now, why did you pay $5,000 more for the car?
Because
you didn't have the money to pay cash. Right? Because you didn't have money, what was taken away from you?
Money.
But if you've got money, what's given to you?
Money.
See? That which you have, you'll be given more. And that which you don't have, then that thing that you don't have will be taken away. You know, that applies to everything. Now, because of this, there's a tendency for the rich to get richer and the poor to get poorer. Ever hear that one? And as a result, we could have a great imbalance over time of income, where you might have a few people with a whole lot and a lot of people with very little. So in theory, okay, and a big part of this is theory, all right? In theory, we have government, we have a progressive income tax, whereas as your income increases, not only do you pay more in income tax, but a large percentage of that income is paid in taxes. And the justification for that is that we're trying to even out this gross uneven distribution of income. You know, we're those who make the most income pay a much larger share, and then we transfer that money through government programs to the people who have less money. Now again, that it doesn't always work that way in reality, and we're going to see that there's a lot of exceptions to that, but at least that's the justification for our progressive income tax, where we have different tax brackets, and then each dollar is taxed in according to what bracket that dollar falls in. And the higher the bracket, then the larger percentage is the income tax. And we have 7 or 8 different tax brackets, you see. So that's what's called a progressive or graduated income tax. But at any rate, this is one reason given why we need a strong central government, is to sort of even out this this distribution of income so it doesn't become so uneven. Another reason we need government is that we may need government intervention during periods of hyperinflation or growing unemployment. Now, this is something that we just this came about because of the New Deal, President Roosevelt, during the 1930s, where government moved into areas, increased spending to finance public programs in order to fight the unemployment problem. You know, in 1932, the unemployment rate was 25%. So we had, plus a lot of those people that were working experienced a tremendous decline in their wages. And Roosevelt came in with what is called his New Deal programs, and we had a big increase in government programs that would borrow money and then try to transfer that money to unemployed people. And that's exactly what's happening today, right? In fact, we've actually heard a lot of talk recently about the New Deal and President Roosevelt because our government today is in the process of a similar program, not seen since Roosevelt in the 1930s. Now, again, we're going to look at this in more detail later because there's a wrong way of doing things and a right way of doing things, and there's a disagreement. But at least as a society, what I'm saying here is that since 1946, with the Full Employment Act of 1946, we, as a society, we've said, okay, you know, this is one of the roles of government. This is a bona fide, sanctioned role of government. You see, before 1946, it was never official. Before 1946, well, okay, Roosevelt did it, it was never really recognized that this, I mean, this is a something we expect from government. And then in 1946, we said, well, along with all these other things, we expect the government to intervene during periods of inflation or unemployment. Okay? Now, there are other reasons, by the way, that we need government that I haven't talked about. For example, we need government to enforce rules of the game. I mean, to have a uniform system of weights and measures. I mean, if I say a gallon, if I think a gallon is so much, and then I go to California, is a gallon in California the same as a gallon here in the East Coast? I mean, is a gallon of milk a gallon of milk? Yeah, why? Because we all agree on what a gallon is, right? A gallon is so many ounces, and an ounce is, you know, so much. I mean, if I say a foot is about yay long. Well, if we go to California, would they agree that a foot is yay long? Yeah, we all agree on how long a foot is. You know, I mean, there was a time before strong central governments when no one could agree on how long a foot was. I mean, you would go to one town and people thought a foot, you know, was so you know, long, and then you go to the next town, and in the next town, people thought that a foot was, you know, maybe twice as long. Or, you know, we say, well, a pound weighs so much. And then you go to the next town and they say, well, no, a pound weighs this much. You couldn't go very far and no one would, you know, could agree on, a uniform system of weights and measures. So how is it that we need to agree on how long a foot is and how much a pound weighs? Well, we need government. The government says, okay, this, you know, we're going to apply, this is how much a pound is, this is how much a foot is, and we're all going to agree on it. How does the government, by the way, promote full employment, price stability, and growth? How it promotes this is by what are called monetary and fiscal policies. Now, what is a fiscal policy? A fiscal policy is a use of government to influence aggregate economic activity through taxing and spending. Now, see, we have two institutions here. We've got the federal government on one hand, and we've got the Federal Reserve on the other. Now, technically, the Federal Reserve is not a part of our government, although we call it the Federal Reserve, and there's a lot of cooperation and interlinking here. But technically, the Federal Reserve is not a part of our government. The Federal Reserve is our central bank. Now, we have two sets of tools that we can use to try to fight either an unemployment problem or an inflation problem. One set of tools is by the federal government. Things like increase in spending or decrease in spending, or increase in taxes or decrease in taxes. Those things are called fiscal policies. Now, for example, under the Obama administration, we've got a great deal of a big increase in government programs and an increase in spending. These things are called fiscal policies. You know, this year is expected that the government will increase its spending and increase the deficit by about $2 trillion. Now, our whole national debt right now is somewhere near $11 trillion. So we're thinking of increasing it by $2 trillion, you know, within a matter of 12 months. Now, I'm not going to get into all the details there, but these government programs are called fiscal policies. As a group, they're called fiscal policies. Now, what are monetary policies? Well, monetary policies are policies of the Federal Reserve. Now, the Federal Reserve, as our central bank, can either increase or decrease our nation's money supply. Okay, when you look at the Federal Reserve, you think of money. In which problem would the Federal Reserve want to increase the money supply? Inflation or unemployment? Unemployment. If we have unemployment, the Fed says, all right, we're going to try to increase the money supply. If people have more money, that they'll spend more, demand goes up and jobs will be generated. Or if we have an inflation, the Fed would what? They would lower the money supply. They would take money out of the economy. People would have less money. They would spend less. Demand would go down, and eventually prices would come down. These collectively, there are many ways that the Federal Reserve can do this, and we're going to look at that in more detail later, in a later chapter. But collectively, these are called monetary policies. So federal government, fiscal policies. Federal Reserve, monetary policies. Two sets of policies, tools that we have to try to fight either an inflation or an unemployment problem. What is a federal system of government? Responsibilities are shared across levels of government. What is it that our Constitution does that preserves our freedom? First of all, what is the biggest threat to our freedom? And what is it that the Constitution does to preserve our freedom? See, the biggest threat to our freedom is centralized power. See, why is centralized power a threat to our freedom? Because once we have a dictator, and sometimes we can have a dictator but not a name, but once anyone or any group of people take on too much power, then they can use that power to enrich themselves or for their benefit and to the detriment of everyone else, right? I mean, whoever got power can say, well, this is the way we're going to do it. And if they've got the power, then that's what's done. You see, what our Constitution does is that it divides up the power. It defines who's got what power. See, in this country, we've got a president, but our president's not a dictator. I mean, he doesn't have all power. I mean, he's got certain power, but only that power that is given to him in accordance to the Constitution. See what the Constitution says is, the President of the United States shall have these powers. The Congress, or the Senate even more specific, the Senate has these powers. The House of Representatives has these powers. The states have these powers. Local governments have these powers. You see what I mean? I mean, see, it says, okay, you know, no one has absolute power. You know, we have this authority here, and this group has this authority, and this group over there has got, you know, another authority. But power remains decentralized. See, if the biggest threat to our freedom is centralized power, then the only way to preserve our freedom is to make sure that power is not centralized. And how do we do that? By having a constitution. Are y'all with me on this? I mean, this is pretty basic stuff here. I mean, if you can understand our economy and our political system, because it's all intertwined, you've got to understand certain basic things. And this is a real basic thing here, because you see, if you as citizens, you know, aren't aware of these basics, then it's easy for them to be taken advantage of. It's easy for certain groups to bring onto themselves a certain amount of a great deal of power, and then once they do that, then we lose many of our freedoms. And sometimes we can lose our freedoms and not even know it. In fact, that's usually the case. You know, we lose our freedoms and not even know it, because it happens slowly. I mean, y'all know the story of the frog in the water. You know, I mean, if you want to boil a frog and you put him in a pot of hot water, what's he going to do? Jump out. But if you put a frog in cool water and just turn the heat up a little bit and then turn it up very slowly, then eventually you'll boil the frog and he'll never jump out, because the change takes place so slowly that the frog never realizes that he's in danger. And that's exactly what it can be like in these United States. You see, we can lose our freedoms bit by bit by bit, and we can become numb to it, because it's just like that frog in the water. I mean, we just lost it bit by bit, and we really weren't aware of what was happening.
It's already happened.
Well, it's already happened to a large extent. Now, remember, how do you open your eyes? You open your eyes by recognizing that what is the biggest threat to our freedom? Centralized power. Anything that leads to more power in a central location is a threat to our freedom. It doesn't make any difference where that power, who, it doesn't make any difference who is in control of that power, where it comes from. Centralized power is the biggest threat to our freedom, period. See, that power may be justified in the short run, but once power is centralized, can that power be used in any way whoever happens to come into power? Yes, you see. I mean, maybe even maybe we gave power to somebody because we trust that somebody, but who's to say that that someone's going to live forever? See what I mean? And so in order for us to keep our freedoms, we have to, you know, we've got to make sure that power remains decentralized. And a big part of that is just to understand our Constitution. See, I mean, you know, a lot of people don't even understand our Constitution. And a lot of people in government do things against our Constitution, but no one ever says anything, because most people don't even know what the Constitution is. Anyway, we'll talk about more on this later, because, you know, there's a lot happening out there today. But right now, we're just hitting the highlights and looking at the bigger picture. But this is what is called a federal system of government. A federal system of government says we have a federal government, and then we got state governments, and then we got local governments, and each has their own set of powers. That's called a federal system of government. Okay, this just shows us how taxes have increased, generally speaking, over the years. You know, taxes can go up and go down, but generally speaking, you know, since let's say that the 30s, they've increased. See, I mean, that just makes sense. If we have a bigger government with more government and bigger government programs, ultimately, where's that money got to come from to fund these programs? From us. And us is by way of taxes. Now, in the short run, we can borrow the money. But ultimately, when this money's got to be paid back, I mean, ultimately, where's that money got to come from? Us. Ultimately. Because remember, this is another important thing that we talked about earlier, but it's so basic. When the government spends a dollar, how do you and I, what are the three different ways that you and I are going to pay for that dollar here and now? Okay, the government spends an extra dollar. Where's the most obvious place that dollar can come from?
Taxes.
Taxes, taxpayers. Now, if the government spends an extra dollar but doesn't take it from taxpayers, where's another place it can get that dollar?
Doesn't take it from the taxpayers?
Right. Where's the dollar come from? Well, I mean, that's, it could, but what's the most, the government spends an extra dollar, but it doesn't tax anybody a dollar.
Okay.
Where's the most obvious place that dollar can come from?
Debt.
It borrows it. Now, who's it borrow the dollar from? Us, who's ever got the money, right? I mean, that might be us, meaning Americans, or it could be what? I mean, who is our bank? Well, the Federal Reserve is our official bank, but unofficially our bank is China. China is our bank in the United States. We borrow money primarily from China. Now, so when the government spends a dollar, an extra dollar, but it doesn't raise taxes, it's got to borrow that money. And the fact is that most of the money borrowed today is from foreigners. And the majority of that money borrowed is from China. See, the United States, I mean, if you look at the United States on a worldwide basis, you know, we are no longer a country that produces goods and sells to other countries. We, you know, over the recent past, we have made money by creating financial instruments and taking advantage of the appreciation of the value of those instruments. Of course, that was true up until about a year ago. Of course, what's happening to the value of those financial instruments today? Well, they plummeted. They become worthless. See, essentially, the United States is broke. Essentially. Our banks are zombies. They're broke. Essentially. I mean, why is the government spending all this? They just passed an $800 billion, what they call a stimulus bill. Because we're broke as a nation, and our banks are walking corpses, and we're trying to breathe life into these corpses. I mean, y'all got to understand this, that this is the times that we're living in. But then, first it was the Roosevelt administration of the New Deal, and then came World War II. And historically, you know, we recognize that increase in spending of both the Roosevelt administration and World War II is what brought us out of the Great Depression, which is what the government is using to justify this tremendous increase in spending today. They're saying, well, you know, back then we had this terrible unemployment problem, and this is how we got out of it. So we're going to do the same thing today. But the big difference is that back then, were two differences, really. One is that back then we didn't have the big debt that we already have today. And number two, we were a country that produced goods still, and today, we're, you know, that's much less true. So, I mean, you know, the situation today is vastly different than the situation back in the 30s. But this is what is used as a justification of this tremendous increase in spending. And, are we raising taxes to increase, to meet this big increase in spending? No. So where's that money coming from?
Debt.
Yeah, see, we're borrowing the money. Now, all right, the government spends a dollar. We don't tax it. We don't borrow it.
Thin air.
Thin air is a good answer. Thin air is a good answer. It comes from nowhere. We create it. You see, how does the government borrow money, first of all? What technique does it use to borrow money? It sells bonds. Every penny that's ever been borrowed has been from the sale of a bond. Now, most time, the government sells bonds to people who have the money. That might be us, it could be businesses, it could be states, it could be foreigners. It could be anyone who's got the money that's willing to buy the bond. And it could be the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve can take money it has and buy the bond. But the Federal Reserve can do something that no one else can, including the government. The Federal Reserve can create money. And this is what's called monetizing the debt. The U.S. government goes to the Federal Reserve and says, we're going to sell you $500 million worth of bonds. Now, because the Federal Reserve is the federal government's bank, where it has accounts, the Federal Reserve simply pushes a few keys on a computer and credits the government's account by $500 million. This is just an electronic impulse. But all of a sudden, the federal government, on a certain account that it has at the Federal Reserve, now has $500 million in it more than it did before. But it's just an electronic impulse. And then the government goes out and spends that money, writes checks against that money, and those checks are good because that account has got the money in it. But where'd that money come from? From nowhere. It was just an electronic impulse. Somebody just punched a few keys on the computer. That's called monetizing the debt. Monetizing the debt is when the federal government sells bonds to the Federal Reserve, and the Federal Reserve creates money to buy the bonds. See, when we talk about increase in money supply, just a small part of our money supply is in actual dollar bills. The vast majority of our money supply is just electronic money. It's just debits and credits. And that's what we're doing here. We're creating money by an electronic impulse. Now, if something becomes more plentiful and easier to come by, what happens to the value of that thing? The value goes down. Right? It's easier to come by, and it becomes less scarce, and the value goes down. Well, if you're talking about dollar bills, and we have more dollar bills out there than we did before, and so that they're easier to come by, what happens to the value of each unit? Goes down. Well, if the value of each unit goes down, when you and I go to buy something at the store, what happens? Well, it takes more of them, which essentially is the reason the price goes up. And that's what we call what? Inflation. So in other words, if the government's going to spend an extra dollar, that dollar's got to come from taxes or borrowing or the creation in terms of new money. Those are only three places a dollar can come from. Now, if the government taxes us, who pays for that dollar? But who's we? Who pays for that dollar? Well, It all depends how the tax laws are written, right? And we can write the tax laws whichever way we want, right? All right, if the government borrows the money, then who pays for that dollar?
Whoever they borrow it.
No. No. See, whoever they borrow from, they're the ones who are gaining from it. But who's paying for it? No, the government borrows the money. So how do you and I end up paying for that here and now? And who pays? Now, if the government borrows the money and the demand for money increases above what it was, in a free market, how do we decide who gets the money? What's the price of borrowed money? Interest. The price of borrowed money is interest. If the demand for money increases, now when we say demand for money, we're talking about people who go to a bank, for example, and say, I want to borrow money. That's what we mean when we say that the demand for money is increased. Okay, so now the demand for money increases. See, the government's borrowing a bunch of money. So they're going out and they're saying, we're demanding money. We want to borrow more money. The demand for money increases. So what happens to the price of money, everything else being equal? The price of money goes up. What's the price of money? Interest. So if the government borrows the money and interest rates are higher as a result, who ends up paying for that dollar, that extra dollar that the government spent? The ones who pay are the ones who pay the most interest. Because if you pay interest and those interest rates are higher than they would be otherwise, you're paying more, right? See, a person who's debt-free and then is not paying interest, well, they're not paying that dollar. But if you're paying interest and those interest rates go up, well, then you're the one who's paying for that extra dollar. See what I mean? All right. The government spends a dollar. We don't tax it. We don't borrow it, but we create the money. Well, now if we create the money and dollar and dollars increase in circulation, and the value of each dollar goes down, when you and I go to buy something, prices are higher. We call that what? We call that inflation. Now, is everyone equally hurt by inflation?
Yes.
No. No, some people are hurt and some aren't.
I mean, they still have to pay that increased price.
All right, let's say that you're a low income or even a middle income person and a large portion of your income goes to buying things like food and gas and rent and mortgage payment and things like that. Now, for you, Then when you go to the store and you buy something, because those purchases represent a pretty large portion of your income, you're hurt by that rise in prices. Or if you go out to the store and buy anything and prices are high, you're hurt by it. But let's say a wealthy person, let's say that only 5% of their income goes to buy things. Now, okay, we got inflation. So when they go to the store, they got to buy, you know, they got to spend more money for food. Are they hurt by that inflation the same as the low-income person?
Not as much.
Not as much. And we're talking about a relative thing here. It's not either or.
If inflation increases and keeps increasing, they will eventually be hurt.
Oh, yeah, they're hurt. But who's hurt the most by inflation?
The lower-income people.
Yeah, exactly. The lower-income people are hurt the most because for a low-income person, a larger percentage of their income goes to buy things that have now gone up in price. Whereas the more wealthy people, well, they're hurt too, but not nearly as much. See, the point is that when the government spends a dollar, you and I is going to pay for that dollar here and now. The only difference is who pays and how do they pay. See, right now the government has just passed this $800 billion bill where they're going to increase spending real quickly here by $800 billion, which is almost $1 trillion. That's just the spending part of it. And that's just the, by the way, that's just the extra spending. That doesn't include any of the spending that they were already engaged in. So who's going to pay for that? Well, we are. How? Well, it depends on where the money comes from. See what I mean? And where it comes from is going to determine who pays for it.
So would you think on like credit card debt, like credit card, like interest and stuff for that?
That's an excellent question because interest rates are interest rates. And all interest rates rise and fall together. Now, they don't rise at the same time, and they don't rise by the same magnitude, but it's like the ocean. I mean, you know, the tide comes in and the tide goes out, and all boats on the ocean rise and fall together. Well, that's kind of like what interest rates are. If interest rates go up, they go up. That's on credit cards, that's on mortgages, that's on everything else. Now, again, you know, some might go up before others, and some might go up more than others, but if interest rates go up, they go up. So whoever is paying interest, regardless of what kind of interest you're paying, eventually, you know, you're the one who's going to pay for that extra spending. And not all people, you know, there's lots of people who not only do they not pay interest, but they receive interest. A big part of their income is in interest. They got their money tied up in bonds and CDs and things like that. And so when interest rates goes up, what happens to their income? No, that goes up.
Their income goes up, but the interest rates go up?
Yeah. If interest rates go up, they go up. If your income is based on interest and interest rates goes up, what happens to your income? See, we got winners and we got losers here. Some people win, some people lose. Now, in this case, if you're debt-free and you're earning interest, then you gain. But if you're struggling and living from payday to payday and you're paying interest, then you lose. Okay?
What about bankruptcy? Like, does the government pay for people to be like, once you declare for bankruptcy, you got all this money that you owe, like the government wipes all that away?
Well, it depends on what bankruptcy. There's chapter 7 and chapter 11. And in accordance to a bankruptcy law that was passed about 2 years ago, it's much more difficult for the average person to simply wipe away their debts. I mean, today, if you declare bankruptcy, you can't just wipe away your debts. Usually, you can work out repayments with your creditors, but you can't wipe away those debts as easily as you used to. Because the credit industry lobbied Congress and they got a law passed that greatly made it more difficult for people to declare bankruptcy. Now, why is it easier though for people to walk away from a mortgage? You know, I was just reading that last year 2.5 million people just walked away from their houses that they owed a mortgage on because they owed more in the house than what the mortgage was worth. They owed more in the house than what the house was worth. And the reason is that mortgages are the type of loans is what's called a non-recourse loan. They're recourse loans and non-recourse loans. And a mortgage is a non-recourse loan. What a non-recourse loan is, we're going to lend you the money for a mortgage, and you're going to use the house as collateral, but that's all you're putting up as collateral for the debt.
But once you lose the house, and if you walk away from it, they just keep the house and
yeah.
Keep all the money that they...
But you keep everything else.
Yeah.
In other words, your other assets are not put in jeopardy. Whereas with a recourse loan, the money... when you owe money, then all your assets would be liable. So, like, if you borrow money some other source and you can't pay the back, then the bank says, "Well, you got to sell your car, you got to sell your house, you got to sell your boat." You know what I mean? And you have to divest yourself of all your assets to pay back as much of this loan as possible. That's what a recourse loan is. But mortgages are not, we're the only country in the world that lends money on houses on a non-recourse basis. But that makes it easier for people to walk away. You know, you can walk away and say, all right, I bought this house on agreement that either I'll give you the money or you can have the house. And I've decided that it's not to my best interest to continue giving you money, you know, talking to the banker. So here are the keys. And that's what's happening today by, you know, millions. And every month more and more people do that. I mean, the percentage is increasing almost exponentially. Okay, well, let's see. What is tax incidence? I was hoping to finish this chapter today. Talking about taxes. A tax incidence is the distribution of tax burden among taxpayers. So in other words, not all taxes are equal, like with the gasoline taxes. Who pays the most gasoline taxes? Well, whoever drives the most and therefore buys the most gasoline. Who pays the most income taxes? Well, the people who earn the most income. See what I mean? Who pays the property taxes? Well, people who own property. Who pays capital gains tax? Well, anyone who's made a capital gain on some investment, like a sale of a stock or something. And this is what we call tax incidence. See, what is the ability to pay principle? See, there are different philosophies when it comes to taxes. The ability to pay principle says those with a greater ability to pay should pay more tax. This is what our supposedly what our progressive income tax is. It's our income tax is based on the ability to pay principle. Is our gasoline tax based on the ability to pay principle? No. Who pays the most gasoline taxes? Whoever drives the most. Is that based on the ability to pay principle? No, it's based on the use principle. Whoever uses the roads the most, they pay the most. You see? These are different philosophies. Our income tax is based on the ability to pay principle. In theory. What is the benefits received principle of taxation? Well, this is what the gasoline tax is. You see, the gasoline tax is based on whoever benefits the most pays the most. That's called the benefits received principle of taxation. What is proportional tax? The tax as a percentage of income remains constant as income increases, also called a flat tax. A proportional tax or tax, straight tax says that, all right, everyone pays 10% of your income, period. Regardless of what your income is, everyone pays 10%. That's another tax philosophy. Now, almost all economists would agree that a flat tax would be more efficient and could raise more income than the proportional tax or progressive income tax we have today. Now, if all economists agree with that, and that's common knowledge, then why don't we, as a country, revert to a straight or a proportional tax system? Come on now, why don't we do it? If a straight tax would raise more income on a lower tax and be much more efficient, which would be good for the economy, why don't we do it? Well, it would be more fair. Come on now, why don't we do it? I mean, you got to understand these things. Because if we had a straight tax, could politicians use the tax law for their own gain? No. If it was a straight tax, then it would just be whoever pays it would be written into law. It would be simple. Like I was talking about that change in the law for declaring bankruptcy. Well, Why did we change that law to make it harder for people to declare bankruptcy? Well, why was that passed into a law? Because people who lend money, namely a lot of them were our bankers, went to Washington D.C. We call this rent seeking, by the way. Rent seeking is when you pour money in Washington D.C. and you influence legislation to benefit yourself or your group. So banks and other lending institutions went to D.C. and put a lot of money in there and influenced legislation so that they would have laws that benefited them. Now, how do politicians benefit from that? From the money and the political support. Both of those things. I mean, this is how most of our laws are passed. You know, we have this tremendously complicated tax law because of all the exceptions to the basic law. And the exceptions are there because certain people, because of rent seeking, because special interest groups have influenced that legislation, and politicians have used our tax system to benefit themselves in terms of money and political power. So if we had a straight income tax system, could politicians use the system for political favors? No. See, we would take that completely out of the equation. So is any politician going to support a straight income tax? No. Well, I shouldn't say any politician. There are a few that might, but very few. You know, I mean, they might talk. You know, they might talk, oh, yeah, straight tax would be good, and, you know, someday we should do that, and I support that. But, I mean, when it really comes down to it, you're not going to see a change. Why? Well, because why would a politician change something that benefits themselves?
But didn't the government change
it? Well, the government is Congress.
Well, I mean, but...
Government is politicians.
I mean, well, our government based on, you know, us. Couldn't we...
Who makes the laws? Congress.
Right, but we appoint those people.
Yeah, we appoint those people. But they still pass laws based on what benefits them. I mean, so I'm telling you that that's why we have the tax system we do. And that's why, because of political favoritism, why we don't go to a straight income tax. Even though economically, everyone recognizes that it would be the best thing to do. Okay, a progressive tax says that not only do we have a graduated tax, but it's progressive in that the higher your income, then a larger percentage of your income you pay in taxes. That's called a progressive tax. And in this progressive tax system, every dollar is taxed based on the bracket that dollar falls in. Like if the break-off income between a 15% tax bracket and a 21% tax bracket is $30,000 taxable income, and your income is $32,000, how do you calculate your income tax? Let me say that again. The cutoff, hypothetically, between a 15% bracket and a 21% bracket is $30,000 taxable income. Your taxable income is $32,000. That's after exemptions and deductions. How do you calculate with our tax system, how do you calculate your income tax? You pay 15% of the first $30,000 and then 21% of the, what did I say, 20. How would I set? You know, if I said 32,000, then it's a 2,000 above the 30. See, each dollar is taxed on a graduated scale based on what bracket that it's called a marginal tax system. Every dollar is taxed on the margin, which means the last dollar. Each dollar is taxed based on what bracket that last dollar falls in. If that dollar falls in the 15% bracket, it's taxed at 15%. If it falls in the 21% bracket, it's taxed at 21%. See, a multimillionaire will pay the same tax on the first 30,000, my example, that anyone would. But then, tax bill income above that amount, would be taxed at a higher rate. This is what we call a progressive tax. Now, of course, do wealthy people have high incomes? No. High income people don't have high income. Or wealthy people don't have high incomes. Why does a wealthy person not want to have a high income? Because you pay taxes on income. So what do wealthy people have? They don't have high incomes. They have what?
Assets.
See, wealthy people build up their assets while keeping their income as low as possible. See, that's one thing a lot of people don't understand about our progressive tax. You say, okay, we've got a progressive tax, and the higher your income, the more you pay in federal tax, so that's fair. Well, it's fair up to a point, but the real wealthy people, don't have high incomes. They have a lot of assets. They're worth, hundreds of millions of dollars maybe in assets, but their income is very low.
Can't they, give money to, SDPA or something?
Yeah, and also, that's also true. I mean, the more money you make, the more ways there are for you to shelter that money. So it's a fact that, not only do you not have a large income, but when you do have an income, there are more ways that you can shelter that. The more income you have. That tends to be true. Although we've tried to minimize that, it's still true. And so I just explained what a marginal tax rate is, where every dollar is taxed on the margin. And a regressive tax is those who can afford it the least pay the most. Now, a good example of the regressive tax is a sales tax, especially a sales tax on food. If we have a sales tax on food, when you go to the grocery store and you buy food and let's say 5% of that is taxes, then who carries the largest burden of that tax? A poor person or a wealthy person? A poor person, because a much larger percentage of that poor person's income goes to buying food. Whereas a small part of a rich person's income goes to buy food. So the rich person is hardly affected by that sales tax, whereas a poor person is affected a lot. This is what we call a regressive tax. This is why some states, like Michigan, don't have a sales tax on food. You go to Michigan, you go to grocery store, your bill is $100, it's $100. There's no tax on it. Why? Because it's a regressive tax. It's an unfair tax. All right? Now, I got to rush through this. We only got a couple of minutes. Why does international trade occur? The opportunity cost of producing specific goods differs among nations. So, the reason we trade with other nations is that the world's resources are not evenly distributed around the globe. And each nation has to take advantage of their comparative advantage. If each nation takes advantage of their comparative advantage, then people in all nations benefit. And this is one reason why free trade is benefits all nations. Now, in terms of free trade, what direction are we going into in this country? This $800 billion stimulus bill, one of the provisions of all this spending is that the government says that if we give you money, then you've got to spend that money buying an American good, and you can't buy goods from other nations. Now it's like putting tariffs up against other. What it's leading to, as we speak, is a tariff war. And then everyone loses. How many slides we got in this thing? Anybody know? I think we're near the end. Why does the American dollar have value? Or why does any currency have value?
Where it's backed up by?
No, it has value because we can buy goods and services with that money. So you show me a country that doesn't have anything that people want, and I'll show you a country whose currency is worthless. See, what's one reason that the American dollar has declined so much in value?
We don't have what people want.
Because what we did have, what people wanted, were these financial instruments. But these financial instruments have become valueless. And so fewer people want dollars because we don't have as much, you know, that people want anymore. But China's currency is much stronger because they do have, they do produce things that people want. So their currency is stronger than ours. Well, this ends the chapter.